And now, friends, it's time for us to pay a few bills. Songtrust is the world's largest technology solution for global music royalty collection and publishing administration, enabling 205,000 plus songwriters and more than 26,000 publishers to collect their publishing royalties worldwide for over 2 million copyrights. Be sure and visit songtrust.com/pubcast to take advantage of a 20% off discount for a one-time registration just for listening to the AIMP Nashville Pubcast. And now, friends, let's get on with the show. Hello, listeners. On this episode of the AIMP Nashville Pubcast, we are talking with one of my longtime friends and mentors, and I do not hesitate to call him a publishing icon, Lionel Conway. Hello, listeners. This is Tim coming back at you with the Nashville Pubcast, and I am very just ecstatic to be sitting with one of my longtime friends and one of my really dear mentors, Lionel Conway. And we're going to just sit around and chat about publishing today. And if anybody has some knowledge of publishing, it's my good friend, Lionel Conway. I'll give you a little backstory. It started back at a little company called Dick James, which I think a lot of people are pretty aware of in the music business, but given the movie Rocket Man here recently, I think a lot more people know who it is, but they worked with a couple little acts, the Beatles, Elton John, who you were very involved in. We'll get into some of that. And then you also worked for another one of my favorite companies as a kid growing up, which was Island. You ran the publishing division of Island Records with Mr. Chris Blackwell. And in that tenure, you worked with some artists like Cat Stevens and U2 and Tom Waits and Robert Palmer. And one of the ones I did not know you worked with was Paul Rogers. I did not know that you had worked with Paul before he joined Bad Company, which was new news to me. How did I not know that? I'm very surprised. And then from there, you went on to start Maverick Music with Madonna and Guy Oseri. And then after that little tenure that you were with Maverick, that's when you and I got introduced, and you started working for a company called Mosaic Media Group, and you bought my then company, Hamstein Music Group, and that's where you and I began our working relationship. And we both worked for a company called Stage 3 that was based out of the UK with Mr. Steve Lewis. And then after that, we both had some stints at BMG, which bought Stage 3. And that led you to your now current company, Mothership. Is it Mothership Music? Is that the official title?
Hi, Tim. Yes, that's the name, Mothership. Yeah, I started that 7 years ago with a partner called Brett Gurewitz, who was the founder member of a punk band called Bad Religion, and he also owned two labels, Epitaph and another label called Anti, and the act that I basically signed to Anti was Tom Waits. So I still represent Tom Waits from 1983.
That is a long time.
And I still represent him to this day. So it's been a long relationship.
So let's go back a little bit at the beginning. Yeah. How old were you when you started working at Dick James?
Well, actually, I did work for Dick James, but he didn't own the company. I worked for another company where he worked. It was called Sydney Brom. And that was in 1954, which makes this my 66th year in the music business.
Dude, that just blows my mind, Lionel. I don't even understand. I don't even understand how you've done it this long.
I was 15, and I was basically what we called in England a tea boy, is basically, you know, someone who actually does make tea, but also does all the, you know, the manual stuff, menial stuff, like doing all the errands. And it was a terrible job, of which I was only paid £3, which is about $4 a week. But it was... you know, I did meet new people in the music business, which that's probably why I stayed. I mean, I didn't intend to leave school. I wanted to sort of have a decent education. But after getting a job with a music publisher, I decided to leave school midterm. My parents were pretty upset, but I said, I want to do this. I want to stay in the music business. And I did. I don't know if I overstayed my welcome in a long time.
Well, I've always said, and I know this from working with you, that my joke, and you know, I've said it to you, that when I grow up, I want to be just like Lionel Conway. And there's a couple reasons for that. One of the biggest reasons is your passion. And my first question, and I know part of it is because you're so passionate, but is what do you credit this longevity and relevancy to? Because it's not easy, because obviously music changes, trends change, the business changed, and how have you been able to keep, you know, relevant through all these changes and all these years?
Well, I actually, you know, when I think about your career, you just said that the companies that you worked for sold out, and I was always lucky to bounce back, and why was I able to do that? I think all my bosses, now of course I don't have a boss, I do it myself, knew of my passion for music, and also it's taste, isn't it? I mean, you've got very good taste, you know, as far as country, and I have an overall good taste in music. It's all about songs, but also it's character and whether your writers like you, and most of them do. I've had a couple of problems with writers over the years, but you know, I try to do as much as I can for my writers, and I'm established now as somebody that, you know, if I sign anyone, I'm going to work 24/7 on their songs and on everything. You know, I mean, I signed a new band called the Marias, and I've done everything for this band: record deal, I've got them gigs, and you know, I've got the manager. I do everything for them, and I think it's appreciated.
So you're what we used to also joke around and say, you're a full service publisher. You take it from the very beginning to end, development, whatever needs to get done. You put your hands in and you get it done.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, I do get involved, very involved. Yeah. And it's also, you know, it's got to be music that you personally like. Now, over the years, I've had a lot of bands that that I haven't liked. But I haven't played them. I want to play in my car or at the house. But it's been music that I can't play to people. Now, why did I sign them? Because I thought it was fashionably good for me to have a band like, won't mention any names. but 90% of the music that I have is something that I play at home that I really like.
That's definitely I get what you're saying in that, and you held true to that during the years that we worked together, and you allowed me to sign things that I know that you weren't your particular taste, but you trusted me to work and develop, and I'd say we did pretty good together. Most of them worked out.
Yep. No, it was a magic period that both, you know, buying the Bill Ham catalog, and then the Aerosmith and of course ZZ Top I bought as well. They were great catalogs, but the country part was I had a lot of pride in the fact that we built a really big publishing company with the additional writers that we signed, you know, Bob Pinson and Bobby Pinson, who won BMI Writer of the Year, and the other guy,
Brett James.
Brett James. Oh my God! Sorry, sorry, Brett. Yeah,
the one and only.
ASCAP Writer of the Year. I mean, we nailed it. We were fantastic. Unfortunately, these companies get bought and sold. It's happening all the time, even more so now because the multiples have increased because of streaming. You know, it's gone a lot higher than it was when I was buying catalogs.
Well, that leads me to a good question, or a segue to a question, is you truly have seen, I think, music publishing developed, because in the earlier days when you first started out, it was, I mean, it'd been around, but you've seen it more of an infancy into this maturity that we have now of it being basically a bought and sold asset. Walk us through how you've seen, if you could, publishing start on the level of when you first got into the business into the major money that we're looking at now.
Well, when I first started, the expression A&R, a lot of people don't even know what that stands for. It's artist and repertoire, which means that record companies employed these guys to go around trying to find singers, artists. Then their job was to match the repertoire with the artist. So it was a songwriter business back in the 60s and 50s and 60s, in as much that the artist never wrote songs. So that was the R part, was to find songs for these artists. So it was a good times for publishers because they could get their songs recorded by major artists. Of course, after the Beatles, it became, you know, it was much different in as much that artists became writers. But before then, no, they weren't. All those Sinatras and after that, they looked for songs, and so it was easier. But then when the artists became writers, it was tougher. You had to sign writers that were artists as well. So it changed. It changed from like the Beatles onwards.
Do you think the Beatles were somewhat instrumental in that at that time? Or were there other artists at the same?
Absolutely. Yeah. When the Beatles became successful, you found that a lot of the bands started. Oh, they didn't start. They wrote their own songs. You know, when you think of Simon and Garfunkel, they didn't take any covers. You know, they did their own songs. Neil Diamond, Neil Sedaka, they started writing their own songs.
So that's very similar to how it was actually in the 80s in Nashville when I came in. Most artists looked for outside songs. And as we were building publishing companies, it was really a great time to pitch songs. You could build vast catalogs, sign a bunch of writers because the artists didn't write much. And, you know, that was Alan Jackson started writing on, but, you know, big guys like Tim McGraw and Reba McEntire, Trisha Yearwood, most of them at the time when I came in were looking for outside songs. And then all of a sudden now, currently, it feels like everybody wants to write their own songs, which does create a different challenge. It doesn't change the business necessarily. It just changed how you operate as a publishing company.
Yeah, it happened in Nashville maybe 20, 30 years later. But, you know, it definitely started outside Nashville in the 60s and 70s. But certainly you're right. It happened in Nashville, in the 90s?
Yeah, that was about the era.
Change.
Yep, everybody started wanting to write, and you started setting up more artist co-writes as opposed to just the pure writers in a room. And now it's pretty much three writers in a room, usually with a track guy that's writing the track and throwing in an artist. And now we're kind of, it's funny that we're 20 years behind where you started. And you are right. I didn't think about that far, that back in the Sinatra era in the earlier days, that they too just cut great songs.
Yeah, they were great writers. You know, the American Songbook is just full of, but of course it changed once we started having self-sufficient talent. So then in Nashville it changed, but it is changing, right?
Oh yeah.
Those writers that we knew years ago that had hit after hit, they don't have them anymore.
Yeah, we have a new slew of them now. There's new ones that are doing it, but it's a definitely transition. Now, you have, again, had such a breadth of knowledge having started we didn't really transition. You started in the UK, obviously, from the early companies we mentioned, and then you transitioned over to the United States, and you've worked in the country market, you've worked in the pop market. How do you see, you've seen a lot of changes in deals. I'm getting specific now on just, I've watched the publishing deal start to transition. How do you see things changing in the future? Because I've seen some challenges in doing deals because obviously cuts make no money. Streaming numbers are starting to become better, but it's not up to snuff. But how have you watched the deals themselves transition?
It is a lot different now. You know, before there was, we did co-publishing where, you know, you got 25 and the band got 75 and you got life of copyright. That's changing now. unless, of course, you know, it's below the radar and the act is looking for some money and they have to, you know, they have to do a publishing deal. I don't force that, but those are the deals that I'm looking for, below the radar, where an act needs help, they need some money, and I'm still able to do those sort of deals, you know, where you get a little bit. But, you know, the majors are doing, even the majors are doing very small, very short reversion. I can't do that because I'm building a business. I can't do short reversions. It does depend on what kind of company you run. If I was running a major now, I would do those deals because you're looking for market share. But being an independent publisher and hoping to build a business, you can't do those sort of COBOL deals. You can't do them. COBOL will sign an act with a very small percentage, with a very short reversion, and it suits them because it's all, you know, it's a volume business for them. It's a volume business. Whereas with me, I'm trying to build a company that has great songs, and I keep them.
And you're trying to build assets, which again, you were really good to me in teaching me because I knew Nashville, but you really opened me up to the global market of what international publishing means and what it means to actually build a company and from the basics of like building NPS and all that. And I just can't understand the reversions. I get that this is where we're at, but you cannot build an asset off of that. Like down the road, even these majors, if they do enough of these, they don't build the catalogs anymore. I don't know how it's a sustainable model in where we're going and how you can do that. And again, my whole career has been independent and I've never done reversions, but I am getting pushback a lot on that now. This is the new thing. Like after 10 or 20 years, they want to revert.
Yeah. Well, you know, you were saying that Nashville is behind.
Yes.
Yeah. As far as songwriters and now they're behind on deals because it's very rare that you get the kind of deals that we're used to, that happened to us all the time. And lawyers do not want to give you they want reversion. They want an advance. And, you know, I can't really compete with that. And probably you can't either, but the majors are doing these deals now. It's not just the cobalts and those sort of, you know, it's the majors that are doing short reversions.
But do you see that in the future being problematic with their ability to sustain?
Yeah, well, I think what the deal, I tell you what's probably going to happen is that because any band now that does fair good numbers on the streaming companies, that are, say, doing a million a week, and that's not unheard of, they're getting nice checks from Spotify and YouTube and all the others that they can afford not to rush into deals, not just for publishing, but records. And you'll find if you go through, like, these bands that are doing million, 2 million a week, that they're not doing publishing or record deals. Now, publishing deals, they do need. They need somebody to, you know, it's become a very, very, it's like a Wild West. You know, you really need to navigate around what's going on in the industry now with collection of royalties. So they need a publisher. Now, do they need to do a joint venture or a co-pub? Not really. They don't have to. But, you know, with 24/7 service that you and I give these acts, then I expect to get that. And, you know, I'm 95% of the acts that I have, I do have long-term or life of copyright. But I do, you know, I'm available 24/7. They're royalty states. I go through them so that they understand where the money's coming from. So, I mean, I do a lot more than what the majors do. And I know what I offer.
Well, that's the, again, having worked together, I learned a lot on how to walk them through the money. And that's really the key. And I would say this to any independent artist that at least on an admin level, although like you, I prefer get some copyright added in. that you need to collect your money. And it does help when you have licensings coming at you and sync and international territories and have somebody help funneling. You can be leaving a lot of money on the table if you don't really get organized.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I took over an act just recently, and they hadn't registered overseas, so they weren't getting any foreign income. They hadn't registered their works with Spotify or the streaming company, so they weren't getting paid any digital. It's crazy, but they were getting nice checks from the mechanical side, the master side. When they own the master, they're getting neighboring rights overseas, and they're getting sound exchange from America domestically. So they're getting nice little checks, and they don't worry about anything else. And there's maybe, they're leaving probably 50% of their income because they haven't done a good job in policing their music.
And that is a value. And again, I can't stress enough that I find that people that are like that haven't had publishing deals or at least experienced what you and I are talking about of really serviced publishing, where you're not just, an income stream that's parked on a shelf, but that you're getting a time and attention and growth and feedback and all the administrative back end, where we're making sure your money's collected and helping explain to you where your money's coming from and helping all that flow that. And again, this is why I love publishing, because it's such a value added. And I do feel that long term, publishing companies are going to be still around as long as they can be, because we are also transitioning into, and you've mentioned it, and you work with a record label, that we are now the A&R. You've probably seen this firsthand from where labels were intimately involved in A&R to now, because of asset and time and everything, they don't have as much resources to put into that. And we as publishers are the ones that put all the work into developing these acts that then get shopped. Like you mentioned the Marias, I'm sure you were, again, very intimately involved at the front end to help them move forward into getting their deal, correct?
Yeah, very much so. I mean, if it hadn't been me, they wouldn't have probably been able to do any shows. Because there are a lot of things to buy for a new young band, and that's without me, they couldn't have done it.
And that's a good reason to continue to build a relationship with your publisher and find a good publisher that's willing to walk with you, especially with independent artists that are trying to grow their brand. Don't think they need a label or whatever. Again, financially, it's just so important to keep all that together. And there's a lot, as you just mentioned, you went through a whole bunch of income streams really fast. If you don't have all that taken care of, you're leaving just so much money on the table.
Yeah.
Now, how do you feel? I saw a panel recently with David Israelite talking about fractional licensing, of being able to pull some of our rights out of the PROs and direct, to your point, do more direct licensing, particularly the digital. They tried to do it, a few years back, and they basically said we couldn't do that. If you pull one right, you have to pull all of it, and we were not prepared administratively to handle that. Do you support that decision? You think that's a good move for publishers?
We have something in this country, and it's not so bad here, actually. It's overseas. The blanket license is where your works that are placed in TV or radio are negotiated by a tariff, a card. You don't negotiate. A blanket license. Anyone can use your music. They have to pay, but the payment is by tariff rather by a negotiation. This country's much better. You can negotiate every sync license and every recording license, but overseas, it's 90% of the business is handled by a blanket license. So you don't have any source of direct negotiation with whoever uses the music.
We hope you've enjoyed this episode of the AIMP National Pubcast. Subscribe now on your favorite podcast platform and follow us at AIMP Nashville to keep up with news, events, panels, and even new episodes. The AIMP National Pubcast is created by Executive producers Dale Bobo and Tim Hunzi. Producer Brandon Harrington. Mixing and editing by Casey Porter. Thanks for listening and supporting the AIMP Nashville Pubcast.